Hello everyone and welcome to this week's Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme for teachers, policymakers and anyone with an interest in teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney and you can download podcasts of previous programmes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. One of the keynote speakers at the 2017 Literacy Association of Ireland's 41st Annual Conference was Brendan Culligan. Brendan was a primary school teacher for 30 years before he started working full-time as a teacher educator. His books include Improving Children's Spellings and Spelling and Handwriting. Most recently, a handwriting series he developed, Go With The Flow, was published by Fallons. Brendan's professional development courses are very popular with teachers who particularly appreciate his insights on teaching handwriting and spelling. The teaching of spellings was central to his keynote address at the Literacy Association of Ireland conference, though you might not recognise that from the title. His address was titled, More Than 125 Years of Crushing Garlic. I asked Brendan what that title had to do with literacy, and this was his reply.
125 years ago in Southwest Australia, there was a guy called A.H. Garlick, with a K at the end of it. And his basic tenet on the teaching of spelling, his theory was that we're teaching it the wrong way. And he said, look, spelling should be taught through the eye and not through the ear. In other words, to move away from phonics and get children looking at words. Now, people like garlic, people don't like garlic in their food, but the most common thing we do with garlic is we crush it. So hence the title, that have we crushed what garlic was saying 125 years ago? And I believe that tradition has crushed him, in the sense that here in Ireland and in schools, we still go the traditional way. And what I would mean by the traditional way would be that we give children lists of words to learn. Sometimes they're just phonetic lists, so based on sound, which would be total anathema to him. And everybody in the class, every child in the class would be learning the same words. So in other words, there was no differentiation. If I was a very weak speller and you were the best speller in the class, we got the same list of words. And that leads on a daily basis, on a daily assessment, to a weekly assessment, or better known here in Ireland as a Friday test, which I would be totally opposed to, because unfortunately many teachers, and indeed many parents as well, they believe that this is the ultimate test of progression in spelling. That, for example, if Sean Delaney's score increases from 11 to 16, that his spelling is improving. And it's not necessarily the case. It just means that you had a good day that particular day, your short-term memory, you held on to them at whatever time of the day they were done. But the thing about that and the short-term memory for spelling and the Friday test or the daily test is that teachers find that a few minutes later, if you want to use these words, they're gone. And Garlick would also talk, and I would talk about what the child uses at one particular time, you know, in a strict test situation, and when they want to use it, it's gone. In other words, it's their objective is to find it and to be able to write the words at a particular time for the test during the day. So when I started off teaching, I was telling the group this morning, it was about 9:30 every morning that I did spelling. I call out this list of words. So if you were in my class, your objective was to know them at 9:30. You didn't care about 9:45 or 10 o'clock. And that, unfortunately, is still very much part of our traditional practice with spelling. And I said, we do spelling, but we don't teach it.
And when Garlick came up with this approach, the visual approach, what was he basing it on? Was it just his own intuition, or had he observed what teachers were doing, or was he a teacher himself?
Yes, he was. All of those above. He saw from his own teaching, and he saw from his own research. And particularly now in spelling, some of his methodologies and reading today, like, you know, would be passe. We wouldn't go down to particularly with comprehension. But when it comes to spelling, yes, of his own observation. It's very interesting here, 125 years later, that children in primary schools are using the methodology of look, cover, write, check, and adaptations of same. You know, I point out to teachers, it's very interesting, the first word in the strategy is look. It is not sound. That is important, that we have to train children from as early as possible to start looking. And what I mean by that is in, you know, reception classes in primary schools or in pre-reception, junior infants, senior infants, we should be training them to look at pictures. to look with intent, you know, give them an objective, like find something. I remember when I was a young fella, we used to get comics, let's say a picture of a farm, and there would be objects hidden in the picture, and we had to find them. Now that's looking with intent. And I believe that we should be doing that with pictures before we move on to words.
So even something like Spot the Difference, would that help?
Spot the Difference, absolutely brilliant. You know, for listeners, if they just Google Spot the Difference pictures, or if they Google hidden pictures, they get loads of stuff free on the internet that will train the young child. But Spot the Difference pictures are brilliant. We tend as teachers, and I did when I was teaching, to, you know, keep those down at the junior end of the school. But you get complex ones, even for adults, you know, if you just Google online, and certainly anything that was going to train them to look. Because if you introduce this looking thing later on in a child's life, they may not understand what you're talking about. You know, what does look at a word mean? And for me, it means, how is it put together? Because there's only one way in the English language the word can be put together. There are certain letters can go together, what we call serial probability. There's only a certain way we can begin words and end words. The example I had this morning was talking about words that have SC, that start with SC, you know, and I took an example from one of the spelling books that's still in use, unfortunately. And we should be telling children where these words can appear in a word, you know, beginning, middle, and end. So if I was teaching, for example, WH for phonics for reading, I would go out of my way to say, look, we can find WH at the beginning of a word, in the middle of a word, but you will never find it at the end of a word. And that's valuable information for children. Now, we had about, I said, close to 90 to 100 people listening to me this morning. And the question I asked them is, what do you do when you come to a word you want to write and you're not sure of the spelling? And everybody agreed, no dissenting voices, that they will write it down and have a look at it. They might write it a different way if they're not sure, but ultimately they base their judgment on how it looks, going right back to what Garlick was saying. But coming back to my title, which created a tremendous amount of interest, actually, that what is this idiot talking about? It's what he was getting at. You know, we've got to go back and we've got to start looking at words. And I think the last time I was talking to you, all those years ago, is that I believe we should be putting words together because they look the same, not because they sound the same.
And we might come back to that in a minute, but first of all, how do you make the transition from getting children to look at pictures to then looking at words more carefully?
I use names, what I call name sorts. Now, there's a tremendous amount of work done on word sorting, but unfortunately, my viewpoint is that a tremendous amount of the word sorting is done through sound. The words are put together because they sound the same. But I would use your name. And I think that's a great stopgap between the pictures and real words, because hopefully by the time you get to first and second class, you will be able to write the name Sean. Now, what can I do with your name? You've got a word in it. You've got a one-letter word. You've got a two-letter word. You've actually got a three-letter word. You've got C, S-E-A at the start of it. And that's what we should be pointing out.
But is that, if we just take that example, is that not confusing? Because S-E-A is a word in my name, but it has nothing to do with the pronunciation of my name.
Yes, and that's what Garlick was trying to get away from. You can get away from sounding things out to looking at things. And when I talk to school staffs about, let's say a junior infant teacher, and you have just told me the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears going to the house. Let's take the word house. There are words hiding inside in house. You've got the word us is hiding in there. And at the end, if you throw on the E, you've got the word use. But that word house won't be in the same group as us and use in any book that's out there, because it doesn't sound the same. And they're thinking, look, you can't do that. You have to keep house for our words. Right? And if you're going down that road, you're really at poles apart from look, cover, right, check. And what I say when I talk to parents groups is that one of the worst things in my view is if I ask you, look, Sean, break it up and sound it out. Right? Because I'm keeping you at that specific stage of spelling development, along the continuum of spelling development, which is called a phonetic stage. If you get the children struggling with spelling, that's where they get stuck. Now, they have to move on to the next stage, which is the transitional stage. In other words, where they start using and looking at words in a different way. In other words, bringing the vision into it. So I would say to junior infant teachers, you're not sending the child home to learn the word house, but you're just drawing attention to the fact that there might be a word hiding in there, as you have three hiding in your name. And that's a place to start. For example, I had a participant this morning, her name was Rachel. Now Rachel has an ache, and she's a teacher. A teacher also has an ache. So we've got to start looking at words in a different way and spotting words in a different way, regardless of sound.
Okay, that might work for individual words, and you've given good examples there. But how does a teacher go about planning teaching spellings of all words to children over, say, their time in primary school? How do you put together a programme if all the programmes that are currently out there are based on sound rather than on look?
This is where we got to change the mindset. If garlic was around today, that's what he would hope that it would continue to happen. But it's going to be difficult because it's very, very difficult to break tradition. The spelling books that are out there at the moment, if you're a very good speller, they're okay. But they're almost full of what I would call busy work. You know, you've got word searches. You know, what exactly has got that to do with improving my spelling ability? You know, okay, apart from the fact that I'm going to be looking, but some of these are presented diagonally from bottom right to top left, which is the way we don't write. You've got another one that I actually hate, and that is unscramble these words. So the words, all the letters are mixed up. And I say, look, that's a crazy thing to give a weak speller. It's fine if you're a good speller. It gives you an opportunity to show off, just like an anagram. They're fabulous for showing the knowledge that you have. But for a weak speller, more than likely, that's what they're doing anyway. They're mixing up their letters. And for the weak speller to be looking at unscrambling these words, and indeed for some parents, they could be looking at it for a long time and is not getting any meaning from it. And that's what spelling is all about, is giving meaning. It is there to represent meaning. If you write a story for me, and if I bring it home as a teacher to correct it, and if I can't get any meaning, well, then there's a huge breakdown in communication. But if I can get meaning, and it's littered with spelling mistakes, it means that your mistakes are not that bad. They're still giving meaning. And that's what we should be encouraging children. We should be trying to make them write. At the Book Award last night, one of the winners was talking about the fear. And unfortunately, that's a word you can apply to children who are struggling with spelling. They're afraid. They're afraid to make a mistake. They want to be right all the time. They're afraid sometimes to come into school on Friday for the dreaded Friday test. You know, because they're struggling with four or five during the week, and then they've got 20 on Friday. My bottom line for the Friday test is that it should be abolished, because it tells you nothing that you don't already know as a teacher. I've been in schools where it begins in senior infants, believe it or not, which I think is daft anyway. But the first Friday, you will find out, you will get a picture of what the children are like. You will find out your best speller and your weakest. And what will it tell you the following week and the following month? It will give you the same picture. And all the weak spellers will stay as weak spellers until I start teaching them. Teaching them, and going back to the question you asked, like, you know, is that you give them a strategy. And you've got to make sure that they're living the strategy. Like, you know, look, cover, write, check. Look is very important, but so is the checking. And unfortunately, they don't do enough of the checking. And unless they're what I call living the total strategy, it may not work. Now, on the other hand, if you are using the strategy and you're doing everything I ask you to do to the letter, and it's not working and it's not progressing, well, then it's not you, it's the strategy. Give them a different strategy. I mean, the old blue book I had was 20 years old now. I have 9 different strategies. So change. The child can change, but the strategy you can change. And what I finished up sometimes with children is taking one piece from one strategy, marrying it with another piece just to progress you. But it's interesting on that point is, how do we measure progression? And coming back to tradition, it's measured quantitatively on the Friday test. I used to get 7, now I'm getting 14, you know, and it's a pity, but that's not the way. There's only one way you find out if I'm becoming a better speller, Sean. Look at my writing. Look at my free story. If your mistakes are getting better, then you're progressing.
Would part of the solution, Brendan, be for someone like you to create a program of spelling for primary school that is based around the look of words rather than around their sounds?
It's been done already in the UK. I mean, say Charles Cripps, a good friend of mine, he has done that. He has put words together because they look the same, and he's actually gone down, which I wouldn't really tie it down to, but he's actually gone in, let's say, for between age of 5 and 7, and 7 to 9, you know, but it has been done already. I have put together a program, which I call Core Words, and it's based on high-frequency words, so I've got Core Words 1 up to Core Words 4, and my words are repeated all the time, so Core Words 1, the words will be repeated in 2, 3, and 4, because I firmly believe that we have to, what I call, overteach these words. If you can write the word there, for example, stand over there, if you can write it once for me, that doesn't necessarily mean the weak speller is going to get it correct the next time. But so the words are kept, they're kept coming back, kept repeating, and they're done through dictation because I believe that it's the best way to do it.
Not by spelling test, by dictation.
Yeah, and not on an isolated list, you know, that they're writing in context. If they do make a mistake, and my system is that I would insist that they would have, they'd have an ordinary notebook from A to Z, and that they would transfer their misspelling properly from their checklist into that notebook, and it becomes their spelling. So very early on in all the classes I would have, and in the last number of years I was teaching, you knew very early in September, Sean, that the notebook you had in front of you, the words that were in it, they were causing you a problem. So that, you know, that's where the differentiation was coming in. The good speller wouldn't have the same words as a weak speller, and that's the way I progressed.
And that program that you developed, where is that available for people?
It's in my two books, the blue one, which is called Improving Children's Spelling, and also it's available in Coverts 3 and 4, or in my second book, Spelling and Handwriting.
You've also written a new handwriting series called Go With The Flow.
Yes, it has taken me 2 years, and I firmly believe that children should be writing cursively from the beginning of schooling. And I put together this, and I haven't called them junior infant books, senior infant books. I've just gone A, B, C, D, because there will be overlaps depending on the child's ability, fine motor skills, etc. Yeah, I'm happy with it. It comes with, I do believe, and I'm biased, a fabulous digital program that will actually demonstrate all the things, from fine motor skills to channeling activities, tracing activities, copying activities, and then finally into letter formation. It goes from single letter formation to double letter formation, ordinary, common, two letter words, three letter words, and so on. So I think I've covered everything in it, hopefully. Although somebody probably will say, look, you haven't done this.
Well, what about the fact that if children are doing cursive script from the start, that script is going to be different to what they're seeing in reading books? Is that a problem?
It ought not to be a problem, because this is an idea I stole when I was researching in French classrooms, that on a daily basis the French teacher would talk about two alphabets. They talk about their reading alphabet and they talk about their writing alphabet. This is your reading E, this is your writing E. And there was no confusion. Now I have adapted that, and there's an alphabet freeze going with my program, that they will see the printed E with a little book, and they will see the written E with a little pencil. And that is done for every lowercase letter and for every capital letter. And my program also is innovative in the sense that I don't do it through word families, which is probably the most common way that letter formation is taught in primary schools. They do this circular movement. They might do an A and a C and a D. Mine is based on frequency of letter occurrence. So, for example, the most common letter in the English language is E. So they start practicing that. Now, the program will rise or fall on the child's fine motor skills, because all that work has to be done. And my recommendation to junior infant teachers would be to take it slowly, not to rush it. Improve my fine motor skills, improve all my pattern work before you introduce me to letters.
And what's the reason for introducing this cursive script so early?
There's a huge correlation between cursive writing and spelling. But to introduce it early from the beginning is that in our system at the moment, the 99 curriculum says that I will write in middle standards in a legible cursive script. Now, what we do is that we start off in a present system of training you to print, right, and perfect your print up to second class. And then if I'm moving into a different teacher in third class, our first job is to forget about all that printing stuff you've been doing for the last 3 years, and now let's start a different system. It is mind-boggling that we do that. We don't do it in mathematics. We start with how we go on. There is no point in teaching something that has to be unlearned, in my view, later on in their school life. And the other very interesting research done at the moment is that, by the time Sean Delaney gets to third class and fourth class, you're becoming more creative, allegedly, with your stories. And then this new thing, it impacts on you. How do I form this letter? It's different to what I used to be doing. I won't say it stultifies 100% my creativity, but it does impact on it. But if you start cursive writing from the beginning, and that is interesting in itself, because that has to be defined. What exactly do you mean by cursive writing from the beginning? For me, it means that when all the preparatory work is done and you actually start forming the letter E, it's just leading in and leading out. There is no joining in junior infants. It is later, when they have their letters done, that you start joining. So what I call separate flowing letters and crips, we used to call separate flowing letters, leading in and leading out. And the leading in is, to me, the most important thing.
So you learn the joined letters, but you don't join them until later.
Yes, correct. The leading in is the most important, because I know now where every letter starts. They all start in the same place, all lowercase letters. Because in print, God love some children, they have terrible difficulty. If you're printing a B, that starts up on top. But if you're printing a D, which looks very like it and causes lots of confusion, that starts someplace else. The C starts someplace else. The E starts someplace else. The D starts someplace else. Right? So some children are all over the place. But when they're doing it leading in, they all know it starts in that place. Now, I may not know where to go next, Sean, but I know where it starts. I know I have to lead into something. But the program clearly demonstrates in three movements how to do that. But it also has valuable information for teachers and in how to correct pencil grip, position of paper for left-handers, for right-handers.
Could there an argument be made that, in fact, handwriting is becoming a dated skill now with the amount of work people are doing on computers and on mobile phones and on tablets and all kinds of devices?
Yeah, that argument is a logical argument, but to me, there will always be a need to write. And there will always be, from a teacher's perspective, there will always be a need for me to teach you how to write, because what happens if these gadgets are not at hand? You know, and then if you have to write something, just take a note or take a message, and you don't have your phone or you don't have your iPad or whatever with you, there's a need to do it. One of the presenters this morning from the States was saying that in one particular school there's no pencil work going on, there's no crayon work going on, they're all into their iPads. I think that's very sad, you know, because even from the fine motor skills point of view, which is very, very important, like, you know, that no work would be done. The thing about using keyboards in Finland, with the education system we all look up to, they have stopped teaching cursive writing, and they're going to teach keyboarding. Now, it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out, but to me that is sad, because if you want to make the letter B on your keyboard, you just press your finger, and there is no physical motor memory of how you actually did that. Right? But if you have to write it, it creates that visual memory, and not only that, but the motor movement to go with it. One of the benefits of that, it prevents the mixing up of similar letters, for example, the B and the D, because they look so different. The cursive B, the written B, looks so different to the written D. You won't have so many children mixing up B's and D's, because the mixing up of B's and D's primarily is a handwritten problem. It's not an oral problem. Sometimes it might be. I might talk about our bog was killed and we have to get a new bog. Right? Or I might be reading that, but usually children will self-correct. But it's predominantly a handwriting problem, the mixing up of B's and D's.
And has much research been conducted in this area of beginning with cursive script rather than the detached letters?
In my view, not enough here. You know, you're talking about Penny Cotton and Cripps and Margaret Peters in the UK. There are some parts of the States where they would have done that as well.
Their findings are all in support of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the big thing is the confusion theory that the most teachers will object to. Look, you're going to confuse Brendan if he's going to be writing cursively and reading print. But it comes back to how we actually teach it. You've got two alphabets. You're reading alphabet, you're writing alphabet.
And is that not a big load on children at such a young age, say if they're 4 or 5 in junior infants, to be kind of saying, well, look, this is one way of doing E, this is another way, and then they're going to have to do the same for the uppercase E?
In what I have put together, I am lessening the load of the junior infant teacher. So by the time they have all their fine motor skills work done, and in my book, Spelling and Handwriting, I have 11 pages of fine motor activities. So by the time they have all their fine motor skills work done and their pattern work and their channeling work and all of that stuff, they only have to teach me 6 lowercase letters in junior infants and 4 capital letters. So I'm lessening their load. So when they go on to senior infants, then they complete the rest of them. And I say to teachers, just don't rush, take it slowly. Now, the lowercase letters are E-T-A-O-I-N, right? They're the most frequent ones. And when it comes to capital letters, the traditional way of doing capital letters was, okay, look, if I'm teaching you the letter E, we'll do the capital. But in my system, no, you won't, because the capital E is the 17th most common. So the most common capital letter is I, because children at that stage are egotistic. I did this, I did that. So you've got I, T, and W, and S are the most common capital letters. So they're the ones we would practice in junior infants.
And the technology argument about spelling, given that people are using word processing programs that have spell checks, and sure, even our phones now, our smartphones, will correct spellings. Mm-hmm. Is spelling a dying art now?
I don't think so. I think it will always be an essential skill that people have. The advent of spell checkers and how they are going to progress in the future, I have no idea. But there will also be always be a need for me to teach you how to spell. Spell checkers are not the panacea of all ills, because they don't pick up anything between 25 and 33% of spelling mistakes. So, for example, if I get a sweet from you, but I typed in, or if I wrote, well, I've typed in F-O-R-M, form, instead of from, it doesn't recognize that as a mistake. The question of homophones won't be picked up with your computer and your spell check. And the other thing is that sometimes when you do type in something and a squiggly line appears, the red one, it indicates that there's a spelling problem here. Now, sometimes they will offer suggestions to you, right? But how are the suggestions offered to you? They're offered to you visually. You have to visually judge, coming back to garlic 125 years ago, so it brings the vision into it. But if I'm a very, very weak speller, and I have given you a word that you can't get any meaning from, or if I've typed in something that makes absolutely nonsense, then no suggestions. So they don't help those most in need. Now, they are a help, right? And I have no objection to children using them, but they don't take away my responsibility from teaching you how to spell.
We're coming near the end, Brendan. I have a few general questions. Who or what inspires you?
I would have to say, I would have to go to the UK. I would have to go to St. Margaret Peter's, and in particular Charles Cripps. And now we're going back a good 25 years in that. But the other thing was that when I spent 15 years as a learning support teacher, in those days we called a remedial teacher, and year after year I had different children coming into my room, but with the same problems. The same words were causing difficulty. So I started making a list of them, which became my core words one, and then I started putting them into sentences. And that's where it came from, the inspiration. If that's inspiration, well, that's where it came from. Really, reading, I loved reading about literacy, and particularly the area of spelling, and then later into the area of handwriting when I saw the connection. Because there's a misconception there on parents' parts as well, and I'm not downgrading parents, but the connection between reading and spelling. The perception out there is that the more I read, the better my spelling will get. If I'm a very good speller, that is the case. But if I'm struggling with spelling, it is not the case, because they're two different skills. You know, and it's very common as teachers, as you know yourself, to find somebody who's absolutely no problem with reading. They'd read for Ireland, but unfortunately they have a problem with spelling. Now, it's extremely rare to find somebody who's very good at spelling and has a problem with reading. Spelling helps reading much more than reading helps spelling. But the inspiration, I suppose, it came from those people.
And that's referring to your own teaching. If you were to go back a little bit earlier to your own experience as a student in primary or post-primary school, what from that experience influences your thinking or your understanding of education today?
In relation to handwriting and spelling that we're talking about, fortunately, I didn't have that many problems in the area of spelling. Now, I'm not a fabulous speller. I'm not an excellent speller, but I was okay. I had this thing about being able to look at a word and say, look, that looks okay. Now, I might be wrong, but to me, it looked okay. In the area of handwriting, was a little bit different, because I had a teacher who was a demon, in the nicest sense of the word, of we used to do cursive writing away when I was in primary school, right? Way back, I'm not talking about the 50s. If you stopped in the middle of a word, for example, he had the knack of knowing that you stopped in the middle of the word and you really got whacked for doing it, right? And a crazy system. But we wrote cursively. We wrote cursively as Berle and as Gaeilge. And there was a beautiful Irish script. You know, you're too young to know that. And it was absolutely gorgeous. The A was much different to the anglicised A. And then somebody in the department in the 60s decided that the standard of Irish writing was so poor, we'll anglicise it and that will increase it and improve it. And unfortunately, no. And we lost a beautiful alphabet. You should check it out.
And that suggestion from Brendan Culligan to discover the old Gaelic alphabet brings this week's Inside Education to a close. Brendan's books are called Improving Children's Spellings and Spelling and Handwriting. And Go With the Flow is the title of his handwriting series that was published by Fallon's. To download over 300 Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from all good online bookshops and libraries. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.